Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show. Today we have with us for the second time from outside of my hometown, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, Dr. Peter Enns. Pete, how are you doing today?
Doing great. Thanks, Luke.
By the way, is it Peter or Pete? Which do you prefer?
It doesn't matter. Either one. Yeah, okay. It really doesn't matter.
Really doesn't matter at all.
Okay. No, not at all.
I'll probably just change it up as we go. I might feel
That's
Peter
fine.
At one point, Pete the next time. Now, before we start talking about your new book, which comes out tomorrow, let's talk about some big news in the Enns household. It seemed like
What happened?
A few months ago, you were on the show. Your daughter was crawling behind you while you were being interviewed.
Yeah.
And she was just a child. And then just the other day, she got married.
Yeah. I think my daughter was 21 when last time I was on your show three months ago. And
yeah.
Actually isn't the same daughter. She was the maid of honor. That's the younger one, Sophie.
It doesn't make the story as good if we focus on the details.
Well, we should lie then. We should just make stuff up, right? So, yeah.
That's
and then the other
I mean.
One, Elizabeth, who's 24, she got married. That was 2 weeks ago. And that was great. It was a wonderful time and sort of surreal, you know, giving your daughter away. But I never thought of it as giving her away anyway.
Which is harder, dropping them off at kindergarten for the first time, taking them to college, or walking them down the aisle?
Ooh. I think the big go-away moment is college. Because kindergarten, yeah, they're not at home all day, but if they start half day or something, then they go full day. They still sleep in your house.
True.
Once college happens, they will never do that again. I mean, even in the summers, you know they're just biding their time because they're going to go back to college in the fall. Mm. And if they come back and live with you after college, that's not good. And most parents don't want that. So to me, that was like the biggest break. Like, I won't see them every day, year in and year out, ever again.
Okay. Well,
and so marriage, you know, my daughter she wasn't living at home now for 2.5, 3 years. So life goes on for us day to day, just like it always has. It's just, I have to remember she has a different last name now, but that's okay.
How long till you're actually going to recognize that as a real last name? Because my sister-in-law got married 5 years ago, and in my phone she still has her maiden name. I'm not sure if the marriage is going to last. I mean, it's been 5 years. It looks like it is, but I haven't switched.
Why risk taking the name? Yeah, I got you. You know, just yeah. No, I don't know. I think she kept actually her last name as now her middle name.
Okay, that's a nice touch.
So that's sort of nice. I mean, I like that. I think that's pretty cool. So
that's a nice tradition. Now, speaking of your family, in your book. The book is titled "The Bible Tells Me So." You include this one little detail about your family, and you almost include it like a throwaway line, which you don't explain, you don't unpack. You just say,
"What did I say?"
You just said, "Yeah, my dad's father was in a concentration camp that he was put there by Stalin," and you just left it there. That's all you said about it. That seems like that kind of detail would need some explaining. I mean, that's a pretty heavy comment there.
Yeah, I mean, probably more technically the language would be a labor camp, but, you know, he was incarcerated, he couldn't get out, so, yeah, I mean, that was just part of my family, you know, narrative, and, yeah, I guess I just sort of threw that in, why not?
Just why not? Why not?
Well, it's true, you know, it's just, you know, it's trying to talk about, you know, this family experiences,
yeah.
And adding it to the idea of the book, so, yeah.
You need to at least get a blog post on that. I expect at some point, let's unpack that a little bit.
Okay, all right.
And maybe that's just because my dad's a psychologist and I want to prod into your family. Maybe that's what's coming out right here. I don't know.
Oh, you want to figure me out. That's
no, I wasn't
this.
Trying
You're
to
figure... Pete, why are you so screwed up? Let's talk about your grandfather.
Well, okay. Since you brought it up, I've got a couple questions for you in that subject. No, I'm just saying it's a substantial issue and...
And there's nothing that a fleet of therapists haven't been able to figure out that you're going to figure out now.
I don't pretend to think I can figure it out, but I just think it's interesting.
Yeah. Well, it certainly is that. It's a world that, you know, I don't say this lightly, that I have been, you know, I have some access to historically in my family that a lot of people don't. I was about to say privileged, but that's, you know, I don't mean that because there's a lot of suffering, there's a lot of pain, and, but it's sometimes good to have those memories in your family to give perspective on things. And you know, we're not from privilege, and that's, you know, it gives me a different outlook than I might otherwise living in America.
Of course. A few years ago, a family showed up at my church, first Sunday. They just moved to Texas from San Diego. He was wearing a yarmulke. They were of Jewish descent, and that happened to be the Sunday I showed a clip from the Band of Brothers when they're at, I think it was Auschwitz or one of the concentration camps, and I thought, good timing there, Luke. Real nice touch.
Right.
Pretty heavy stuff there.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, let's get back to your story and not talking about labor or concentration camps. So you start off the book and you create this pivotal moment in which you have to have this life change. And before that, you were at your homecoming football game at your high school that you went to. You're in college. And right. So you had this moment, which in some ways sounds like a Garth Brooks song.
Yeah.
And there's a discussion between an atheist and a Christian. And up until that point, all you cared about was locating your fastball, which wasn't going too well, according to the book.
Right.
Yeah. And at that point, something clicks. What happens in that conversation?
Well, it was after college, and like you said, setting it up, I was with a friend of mine who was actually best man at my wedding, and he went to Cedarville College, which is, you know, many of you know is a Christian college. And we met up with a friend of ours who had a degree in philosophy and who is an atheist. And those two guys started, for whatever reason, I don't know how this happened in the parking lot of a football game, but they started discussing, debating, but in friendly ways, you know, God and the existence of God and things like that. And I had no idea what they were talking about. And I went to a Christian college. And that had, you know, it's just one of these little moments that sort of has an impact on you that you can't script. There was no divine light shining through the clouds. It's just this moment where just pieces of my life came together. And I said, you know, Pete, you claim to think of something, you claim to believe something, you claim to follow Jesus, and you don't have any idea what you're talking about. So that really started me on a very different path than I was ever on, which is to do a lot of reading. I was never a reader in college or in high school, and I sort of became one all of a sudden, literally within a day. I was just reading things. And
It
was that quick. It was like the next day I was already thinking actively. Like, I just... Where are books, you know, that I can read?
And, do you remember the first book you started to read after?
I don't remember the first book. I do remember early on I read The Chronicles of Narnia. Never read them before. Mm-hmm. I mean, my parents wouldn't have done that anyway. It wasn't like them. But, and, you know, a book like that just sort of, you know, it helped me understand the role of imagination a little bit in thinking about God. And I did read quite a bit of C.S. Lewis early on. Mm-hmm. I think that's probably a big entry point. And I read Mere Christianity, and I thought it was just very intriguing how, you know, somebody could be reasonable like this and have arguments, you know, not knock down, drag out, slam dunk kinds of arguments, but still mm-hmm. like a very reasonable, gentle approach to thinking about the faith. And that sort of just led to whole bunch of other things, like including reading the Bible again and again and again and again, and just because I felt like I needed to sort of grasp what was in here, and never really thinking at that point that, you know, I'd go to seminary one day or something like that. That did happen about 3 years later, but, that didn't, that wasn't on my mind immediately. I didn't have a plan.
Yeah.
I knew that something was sort of deficient, and I just wanted to understand.
Mm-hmm. And so you talked about 3 years later going to seminary, and you tell in the book about you're in seminary, and you have your what you call the third uh-oh moment, right? Oh. Now, on your blog, you've been referring to them as aha moments.
Uh-huh.
Now, if I was big into apocalyptic literature, I would connect the dots here, because do you know how many aha moments you've posted on your blog at this point? This is a quiz.
17.
17.
I think it's 17, yeah.
Do you know what page number the third aha moment happened in your book?
Is it 17?
Is that a connection or what?
I don't believe
it
you.
It is true. You've got seven copies of the book right behind your head. It is on page 17, right side.
I have one copy in my pants. So I carry it with me everywhere I go. Okay, was it page 17?
Page 17.
All right.
Tell
the people at home just simmer down for a second.
This is what happens when you have an Old Testament historian not believing me just because I don't have a PhD from Harvard. I just have a master's degree. But you know what? I know how to count. Yep.
Okay.
Am I right?
Yeah, you're right and you're correct. The only thing you're wrong about is that I don't really call them uh-oh moments in the book. I call them turning points, which is similar. Aha, uh-oh, and turning. They're all different metaphors to get at the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Which is something's wrong and I got to fix something here. It's not working.
Yeah. And so that moment is you're in a class, you have a professor who comes from a Jewish perspective.
And remember, this is, you said before Westminster Seminary, this is Harvard. This is my doctoral program early on. So, but the same idea. Go ahead.
Can I tell you something? If I had a degree from Harvard, I would work into conversations a whole lot faster than that. I would work it in every conversation. I would get about 30 seconds in and say, my name's Luke. I went to Harvard. But, okay, so you have a master's degree from Westminster.
Right.
You're at Harvard. You've already been warned that you're going to go experience all these liberals that are going to mess up your faith.
By some people. Yeah. Not everybody. Many just said the exact opposite, but yeah.
Yeah. And so you're there and you have this experience in which a teacher is trying to connect the moving rock.
Right.
You want to tell that story?
Well, yeah, as briefly as I can, there's this passage in 1 Corinthians 10:4 where Paul, it's rather involved, but Paul refers to the rock that gave water to the Israelites in the desert in the Old Testament as sort of connects it to Christ, which is interesting because Paul always does that sort of thing. He brings into conversation, let's say, a lot of Old Testament ideas with Christ. But he refers to this rock as Christ, not just as Christ, but as the rock that followed them,
mm-hmm.
rock that accompanied them was Christ. And I sort of had this moment in graduate school when one of my professors, James Kugel, was lecturing on this to an undergraduate class. Not a doctoral class, not even a seminary class, but an undergraduate class,
mm-hmm.
talking about things I'd never heard of before, having gone to a Christian college and a seminary. I felt like, what the heck's wrong with this picture? Didn't know. But he was talking about an ancient Jewish tradition around the time of Paul and thereafter, possibly earlier, where they also talk of some source of water that accompanies or moves along with the Israelites in the wilderness. And the source of that probably is the idea that you have this episode, and people who've read their Bible probably know this already, you have this episode of water coming from a rock with Moses twice. It happens early on in the wilderness journey in the book of Exodus. Then it happens at the end of the book of Numbers, which is 40 years later. And what Dr. Kugel said in class, just it sort of hit me that that Jewish interpreter sort of assumed, maybe assume is the wrong word, but they sort of had fun with the text, and they said that the rock at the beginning and the rock at the end are not two different rocks. They're the same rock, and so that rock is following them for 40 years in the desert, rolling around literally, as the interpreter said. Anyway, the long and short of it is that what I saw there was I saw Paul being very Jewish. I saw Paul employing a type of handling of the Old Testament that is not one that I was taught in seminary, that's not one that I was taught at college, but yet here it is, and it just seemed patently obvious to me that Paul doesn't think like I do.
Mm-hmm.
He has a way of handling the Bible that's very ancient, very Jewish, which stands to reason since Paul was, wait for it, Jewish.
There it is.
Right? So, yeah. I mean, this is he's not a Protestant. He's not a hipster pastor. He's not a Lutheran. He's not Calvinist. He's not anything like that. He's ancient, ancient, ancient. And that, to me, was sort of a real wake-up call, and I think a very good one, of what is our Bible doing? You know, what is it doing? What is the Bible? What's it there for? And how does connecting with its antiquity help us understand what we're even supposed to be doing with it, right? And so I tell this story in the book that what happened was it's one of these very clear memories I have in my mind where I left the lecture hall where Kugel had said this, and I was really stunned. I wasn't shocked. I wasn't afraid. I wasn't about to give up my life or anything, but I was disoriented. Mm-hmm. In how I thought about things. And I remember walking to the bicycle rack to get my bicycle, and as I was slinging my knapsack over my back to go home, I guess I was going home, I said to myself, literally, Toto, I don't think we're in Kansas anymore. I know that something's happening here. This is I've stepped through something, and I have a choice to make. I can make believe today never happened, which would never work with a German type A personality type who's always looking at things, you know, and trying to ferret out truth. I couldn't do that. I could try to defend the Bible against the horrible assertion that Paul was thinking in a Jewish way, and employing these interpretive techniques, which is what much, not all, but what much of evangelicalism does with instances like that. We can't have Paul saying crazy things. He's got to get it right. He's got to do grammatical historical interpretation. But then, you know, the third, and I call, you know, door number one, door number two, and door number three. And door number three for me was, I don't know what's ahead, but I've got to keep walking through this door that's been opened for me and try to understand something of the nature of God, the nature of Scripture, and how all this stuff comes together.
Have you thought in hindsight about that moment and ever wondered if you should have been a Bible defender, as you call them, if you should have gone down road number two?
That never occurred to me. It never entered my mind to entertain that or to do it. Yeah. I've never even put myself in the place of what would my life have been had I decided to go through door number two. It just wasn't an option for me.
Really?
Temperamentally and intellectually, it simply wasn't an option for me. In an instant, I knew that. I knew that I can't make believe.
Now, if people know your story, they know you ended up back at Westminster, where you did your first master's degree. I know you got one at Harvard while you're getting your PhD. And you're teaching there. You've been there for a decade or longer. And then you publish Inspiration and Incarnation in 05. And that causes this big hubbub. 2 years of a trial. Is that the right word? Trial?
No, it definitely wasn't a trial. It was something that was called a faculty theological fellowship. It was a fairly regular meeting of the faculty to discuss the content of the book and whether it was, safe under the standards that the seminary operates under.
Yeah, and so that group says, yes, this fits. This is evangelical. It fits in the Westminster Confession. But for some reason, they still take it to the board. The board says, yes, his theology fits the Westminster Confession, but we're not going to have him back. And this is this huge drama in which your book comes out that's really saying stuff that you've been teaching for a decade plus, right?
Right. I mean, what happened was the faculty voted roughly 2/3 majority in my favor that the book's acceptable. It's fine. And some of those people who voted yes, they weren't necessarily crazy about everything in the book, but they still said this is all within the reins. Nevertheless, the decision was made to pursue this further on the part of the administration with the board, and that led to a whole bunch of things. But I had been teaching those ideas, since I got there in one
of course,
form or another. And that book is really putting into print ideas that had been brewing in my mind as sort of a synthesis between what I had learned in my graduate study and I guess my theological and faith roots, which at that time were very much in the Reformed tradition and from Westminster. I mean, I owe Westminster Seminary as a student a tremendous debt. You know, I still teach in when I go in churches and stuff, I still teach general parameters and outlines of things that I was taught there about how to read the Bible and how to understand it. But the problem is that there are things that have to be taken into account if you're going to be talking about the Bible, such as its historical setting. And the Reformed faith is actually, I think, well set up to do that, going back to Calvin, because it's always had a strong appreciation for taking seriously context of Scripture, as little as they knew about it in Calvin's day. We know, school children know more today than great theologians of the 16th century because we have cable TV and archaeology. You know, these things are accessible to people. So I felt it was a conversation worth having, using this Calvinist model as a way of explaining to people in general a way of looking at these, historical entities, not as a source of fear or not to unnerve, but to actually give people a sort of space to walk and to think differently and say, mm-hmm. it's all okay anyway, don't worry about it.
So even in spite of all the controversy that ensued following that, you are still glad you took door number three?
I never had, honestly, I have never hesitated in saying I did absolutely the right thing.
Really?
I did what I felt was right. You know, I didn't, it wasn't fanfare. I didn't take a stand. I will, you know, mm-hmm. here I stand, I can do no other. I just, it's who I am to express myself that way. And I think I was very genuine and authentic about how I did it.
Yeah. We have Brian McClain.
Before we leave that, I mean, I may not have mentioned to you, but Baker is publishing a 10th anniversary edition of Inspiration Incarnation next summer.
Really?
And, what I did was I went through the manuscript and I tweaked a couple of things for clarification, but content-wise, it's all the same.
Mm-hmm.
I added some bibliographical items that I think might help people that have come out since the book was first published. I have a very short preface sort mm-hmm. of explaining why we're doing this at all.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a fairly lengthy postscript where, you know, I talk a little bit about some criticisms of the book and why, you know, many of them I just don't think are hitting the mark about what the book's trying to do.
Hmm.
But I talk there again about issues of, you know, Bible and context and inerrancy and what we owe future generations of the church, not simply those who may have lived 100 or 200 or 300 or 400 or 500 years ago. We have to think of that too. So that's coming out sometime next summer. I'm not exactly sure when, but probably July.
Oh, we'll have to look forward to that. So speaking of
you'll have to buy it.
I'll have to buy it. Okay.
I don't care if you look forward to it. That doesn't help me at all. No, I'm just kidding.
Of course. We've got to get you money so you can go buy your Yankees tickets. So, but when that book came out, you know, I asked McLaren the same question when New Kind of Christian came out. I said, did you understand what was going to happen with your relationship with the evangelical community when A New Kind of Christian came out? And he said, yeah, I knew what I was doing.
Yeah.
When you published that book, did you know what was going to happen?
Yeah.
You did?
I knew what was going to happen, and that didn't deter me.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I know I don't want to sort of pose myself as this brave warrior because it wasn't a conscious thing like I'm going to count the cost and I'm going to do it anyway. God is my witness. It was more, I don't know how else to talk. You know, if I'm going to do this scholarship thing, I just don't know how else to talk other than here's what I think. Mm-hmm. And I do disagree with you and you and you and you and you because I've read you and you and you and you and you and mm-hmm. all these questions come up and you and you and you and you don't
mm-hmm.
help.
Mm-hmm.
So let's cut it out. Let's mm-hmm. let's do something about this. What I didn't anticipate was the reaction within Westminster Seminary because I had been teaching these things for so long and because of the Westminster that I knew when I was a student in the 80s, and which was a different tone entirely, and the Westminster of at least the first half to two-thirds of my time at Westminster on the faculty, which is 14 years total. And there was a shift. There was a significant shift in personnel right at the time when I was starting the book. And
really?
That wasn't really complete when I handed the book into Baker, which was obviously before 2005. It was sometime early, mid-2004. So a lot of things just happened to be happening at that time that where the context of the community of the school was very different in 2005 than it was in 2000 or 1999.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, so I think, I mean, I'm only saying that to give some context for that. Whether or not, see, in the long run, my book actually fits in the broader, let's say, conservative Calvinist paradigm, I think that can be discussed. That's a legitimate topic of conversation. But, you know, despite 2 years of talking on the faculty, there was actually very little conversation about the content of the book. And we never really got to the very important hermeneutical and theological issues, I thought at least. It was more defending positions and things like that. There was very little conversation.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Well, some of the big theological issues that you deal with in this new book is basically the three hang-ups you have about faith. As you described them, they were basically the conquest narratives, you know, where God comes in, says, kill everyone, or as Israel thinks God says that. The second is how history, as it's described in the Bible, doesn't match up with historical records that we have now. And third, there's sometimes a variance of understanding of who God is based on different authors.
Right.
That's fair. So let's start with the first one. That seems to be pretty much the worst part of the Bible for a lot of people.
Yeah, and that's why I put it right at the beginning of this little introductory section where I tell my story, because that's sort of like the go-to issue that causes people to sort of drop the whole thing. And then on one level, I just don't blame them, because it's pretty serious stuff. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I felt that was the best thing to start talking about and to offer a different way of thinking about it, at least for people of, let's say, evangelical-ish sensitivities, you know. And I wrote the book for people who have had this Bible their whole lives or are familiar with it, but are finding traditional answers are not helpful to them. And by traditional, I mean traditional conservative answers are not helping them. So,
what are those traditional answers for that?
Well, I mean, there are a lot of them, and I think, you know, one of them is things like, well, the Canaanites really were wicked, and they deserved it.
Okay.
Okay, but I thought everybody was wicked, and they deserve it. And there's nothing the Canaanites did that surrounding cultures didn't do, too. One of the things people pick on is, like, well, they sacrificed children. Well, they weren't the only ones who sacrificed children. The Moabites sacrificed children. Other cultures sacrificed children. So, you know, what seems to be the real offense of the Canaanites in the Bible isn't so much that they were so wicked, and they were so wicked God just had to wipe out every man, woman, and child. The offense seems to be where they lived, and they lived in the land that God promised to the Israelites, which, you know, I think if... you know, I don't think it's too strong a word, although it's easily misunderstood, but there seems to be an agenda on the part of the biblical writer to explain why they're in the land and previous residents aren't. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some would call that propaganda, and many, you know, Christians even write about propagandistic tendencies in the Old Testament. So it seems like a pretty good example of that sort of thing, that this is how ancient people told their stories, and the Old Testament participates in that.
So if someone's going to pick up your book, they're going to read that you basically have kind of two points for this. One is that God didn't actually tell them to do this. Israel just thought God told them to do this. And the second part is, historically speaking, probably didn't actually happen.
Mm-hmm.
Now, for some people, they're going to read this and they're never going to have heard anything like this before. And they're going to go, what in the world is this guy saying? It's in the Bible. It's true. How does it not happen? How is it God not telling them to do this?
Or they're going to say, hey, thank goodness.
Yeah.
You know, so there are different types of readers who will react differently. For some, it's going to be a breath of fresh air. Mm-hmm. And for others, yeah, it's going to be concerning. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, okay, why would someone say, oh, this is a breath of fresh air, instead of the person who's going to say, wait a minute, you're just doing terrible things to the Bible?
Well, I think the difference between those two reactions has a lot to do with community-based expectations of what the Bible is. And I think those things are both, everything I said there I think is important. It's community-based. We're all part of Christian communities where, and especially in the, you know, the Protestant, conservative, evangelical, fundamentalist world, where the Bible has a central place. And not just the Bible, but the Bible understood a certain way, which is basically, the Bible doesn't make stuff up. It may fudge on things here and there, but there's no creation of historical events. Anything that looks like a historical narrative had to have happened. Otherwise, God's a liar and the resurrection never happened. You know, that's the logic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm writing this book not really to tell those people who think that way, you're wrong. Mm-hmm. I'm writing this book for people inside those communities who already know that that's wrong, or feel that that's wrong. And I'm saying, listen, here's another path you can take. And by the way, the water's really warm, and despite what you've been told, there are a lot of people who understand things in this way, and they don't have the same expectations of the Bible that you might have.
So you compare the way that God interacts with Israel in the same way that a father or a mother would interact with a child who's scared that there's a monster in their closet. And you say, the parent goes upstairs, and here's the kid say, there's a monster upstairs. And so instead of saying monsters don't exist, they're not real, they actually go in the closet, they rattle some things around, say, I scared off the monster, they're never going to come back, so you're okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so how can we understand that as how God interacts with Israel in the Old Testament?
Well, I think the illustration that you're pointing to, I used it a little bit later in the book, a similar idea of a little bit later when I talk about how the ancient Israelites assumed the existence of multiple gods.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of Israel, I mean, everybody had their god in their pantheon, and Israel's God, in many places in the Bible, especially Psalms, but Exodus, Job, other places, God is sort of the CEO of some pantheon. He's greater than all the gods, which is why he has the highest place. And I use that illustration about the monster in the closet as, you know, this is the way it's okay with God for ancient people to perceive of him that way, because that is the culture, that's all they knew.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're convinced that there are multiple gods all over the place, to come in and say, well, there aren't any gods, it's just me. They say, you're crazy, they're all over the place. Look at the statue here, go to that temple, they're all over the place. So sort of to adopt a particular ancient mindset on God's part, see, he does this all the time anyway, to adopt the mindset of a particular people in a particular culture to speak into that, it's like a father whose five-year-old, or mother, whose five-year-old is scared to death of monsters in the closet, rather than saying, there ain't no such thing as monsters, which never works.
Mm-mm.
You open the closet door, you walk in, you close the door behind you, you start rattling things around, moving around, boom, 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 maybe screaming a little bit, then you open the door and you say, they're gone, they're never coming back.
So tell me about Israel. What is Yahweh's interaction with the other gods in the Exodus?
Well, in the Exodus, the plague narratives are really expressions of Yahweh beating up the gods of Egypt, so to speak. It doesn't fit exactly with all 10 of the plagues, but with most of them, you have some correspondence in Egyptian pantheons with a god, like, you know, the sun god Ra, who's sort of like the patron god of the Pharaoh, which is the last plague. God makes it dark. Yahweh makes it dark. So, you know, that's showing power over the high god of Egypt on his own turf, right? So, I mean, this is a way of thinking about how great Yahweh is in that ancient culture. This is how they would talk. These are the stories that they would tell. This is how they would tell it. And, you know, for me, that's a very big lesson in just looking at the Bible. It's you know, historical issues are important, but they're not always the most important thing. What's maybe most important is paying attention to the Bible, its character, and how it acts, and how these things would have been heard, and why these things even would have been written the way they're written in the ancient world. See, if you miss this divine battle of the gods in the plague narratives, and at the Red Sea as well, you're going to miss the theology of these texts that they're trying to communicate. So
when you talk about how they're heard, you use the line about the past serves the needs of the present. Can you explain more about what it means for the past to serve the needs of the present?
Yeah, I can. Maybe I should just open the book and read those 400 pages. I think it's a great question. Let me try to sort of boil this down a bit, because I sort of lead up to these kinds of things. But when biblical writers wrote history, when they wrote about the past, and I talk about when these things were likely written, and make a long story short, the monarchic period leading up to and after the exile of the southern kingdom to Babylon in 586 BC. This is the period in which the Israelites would be nationally self-conscious and want to write their story to distinguish their nation over against the other nations around them. This is who we are. This is what makes us different. When those biblical writers were writing about the past, and in some cases the very deep past, like Genesis or Exodus, things that are so far back, they don't even list names of pharaohs who lived back then, as opposed to their own contemporary time, they mention everybody. You know, when they're talking about the deep past, they're not talking about the past simply, hey, let's talk about the past.
Yeah.
They're talking about the past to define their present, to say, this is who we are, this is where we came from, this is what God is like, this is what we're like. and the past actually serves the present. And you know, one example of that is how in the you know, the stories of the patriarchs, for example, you see previews of coming attractions. You see previews of what's going to be very important in the monarchic period. You know, one example is Lot's daughters. You know, he's drunk and he gets them both pregnant, and from them come the Ammonites and the Moabites, which is, you know, sort of like explaining Israel's monarchic political map. Yeah. And placing that in ancient time, and it doesn't put the Ammonites and the Moabites in a very good light, now does it?
Right? That's a very kind way to say what it puts them in the image of. Yeah, that's not a very nice thing to say.
Exactly. Or, you know, another example that I talk about a good bit in the book, because I think it's just it's so interesting, is the preferential treatment by God for the younger brother. Mm-hmm. Not just in Genesis, but elsewhere. And John Levinson, for example, one of my professors also, he has a whole book that describes this sort of stuff, and it's just fascinating. But how, you know, the younger brother is preferred over the elder, that begins already in the Cain and Abel episode, right? I mean, Cain kills Abel, but Abel it gets preferential treatment, so to speak, by God. But you see the younger brother having a preferential treatment over the elder, like Isaac, over Ishmael, you know, Joseph over his brothers. Joseph gets preferential treatment, and he's the youngest, at least until Benjamin is born. He's the youngest brother of the 11, and then second youngest of the 12 later on. But this, see, this preferential treatment of the younger brother, and even hostilities between the elder brothers and the younger brother, that sort of thing is played out during the story of the monarchy. You have King David, for example, who's the youngest, given preferential treatment over the elders. You know, it's almost as if, and I'd be willing to say personally, not just almost, I think this is what's happening. The stories of this preferential treatment are at least in part there to set up the story of David.
So that causes us to have an understanding of the way the Old Testament is telling stories as they're very stylized and more focused on creating a point instead of being historically accurate.
Right, yeah. I think that's a short, crisp way of putting it. That's what I would say. And that doesn't mean, you know, there's nothing historical here. But all attempts to recount the past are stories.
Mm-hmm.
All of them. That's why you have, you know, different versions of the same thing. And one of the illustrations I use in the book is the story of Jackie Robinson, you know, the baseball player who broke the color barrier in the movie 42, which I thought was a good movie, but also Ken Burns' baseball video series that I thought was just wonderful. And they tell that story differently, and they tell it for different reasons, and they're trying to get something else across. And all storytellers do that. They're selective. They even invent dialogue. They have to. Mm-hmm. They weren't there. And even if people were there, they invent dialogue differently. They remember things differently. You know, I can't remember what was said at the dinner table at Thanksgiving last year when we have 12 people sitting around it. But if somebody said, tell the story of Thanksgiving, I'd have to sort of place my imagination back in that time and basically reconstruct or downright create things that are happening. That's just how storytellers do their thing. And to presume that the Bible would never do that, I think that's your first categorical error.
Why is that our first categorical error? Because we would assume that there's like this divine light coming from heaven, we're writing down word for word. And so of course this divine light's going to give us verbatim recounts of what happened.
Well, then I just, you know, would suggest read the Bible and compare Chronicles and Kings or compare the four Gospels. And, you know, those are windows onto the larger issues that are there in the Bible about how did they record history. We shouldn't presume that, you know, since this book ultimately comes from God, which I agree with, since this book ultimately comes from God, therefore it will have these properties, A, B, C, D, and A. And I'd rather say no, I'd rather just try to find out what those properties are from trying to immerse myself in the character of the text. It's a bottom-up approach, which is anathema for many people. You have to go top-down. There is no top-down because we're not on top. Mm-hmm. We're down here. We're reading. And we don't have that magical sort of over the rainbow perspective where we can see what God is thinking. We have no idea what God is thinking. What we've got is the text. Deal with it. Try to construct a view of the Bible that actually, where the Bible isn't an embarrassment, what's actually something that you can say that accounts for what it's like and for what it does.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot healthier.
So you say you still believe the Bible does come from God. If it's not the divine light, explain what that means then.
Well, I mean, it's all our language is metaphorical when we come to things like this, but I think God is, let's say, involved in the Bible. It's a book that's been the book of the church and Judaism too, with the Old Testament, for a very, very long time. It has functioned in a way that has supported, challenged people of faith, and that isn't changing. And I, by faith, I say that's because I think God is involved here. This is his book, so to speak. But one of the metaphors I use in the book, too, is that but God lets his children tell the story.
Yeah.
Right? This is God allowing his children to tell the story of their connection with him, their intimacy with him, their understanding of him, and to tell it in their way that is contextually and culturally relevant and sensitive. You know, not the way I might write a story, but the way they write a story. And it's still okay. It's still good.
It's so good. Okay, so let's fast forward to Jesus. That's where the whole story is pointing. That's where the centerpiece of what's going on. It's Jesus. But you make the point that Jesus is going to appear, and people are going to meet him such a ways that they experience Jesus differently. And that happens over and over again, which makes sense. Everyone has their own experience of God and Jesus, and so it's going to come across differently.
Mm-hmm.
But then we don't have the ability to have the quote-unquote true Jesus, the true God.
Yeah.
And so we played the game. I think it was, who was it? Was it Franklin who had his Bible that he cut out all the miracles he didn't like and cut out all the
stuff? Thomas Jefferson.
Oh, Jefferson, that's right.
Yeah.
Well, okay, so Jefferson ends up with his version of Jesus, who, guess what? Looks just like Jefferson. Isn't it? It's amazing. And we all do the same thing. How do we actually know who the real Jesus is if that's kind of our experience? Like, Jesus looks a whole lot like, he's very sarcastic, in my opinion, because I'm very sarcastic.
Right.
But,
well, thanks for the softball lob question there. How do we know the real Jesus? Well, not all kidding aside, that's been a question that Jesus scholars have been asking in a certain way for the past maybe 150 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't presume to answer it, but you know what I try to say in the book, actually what I do say in the book and what I hope I communicate well, is that, listen, you know, the Jesus we have is the Jesus of the four Gospels. And then also the Jesus that's presented to us by the biblical writers, you know, from a post-resurrection vantage point. And in fact, the Gospels themselves were written from a post-resurrection vantage point. They weren't written there while Jesus was talking. These are written by communities of faith based on both oral and written traditions or documents, and they were telling the Jesus story in ways that make sense to them and helps their community of faith. That's what I believe. That's, you know, I can't go to a book and prove that's what happened, but it seems to make the most sense of the fact that there was tremendous diversity in the gospel records. So, you know, I think the Jesus we have, the real Jesus, is this, you know, diverse Jesus that is presented to us in these various layers of biblical tradition that make it into the New Testament. And you know, there is no way to communicate one Jesus in writing. I mean, you can, but you could just have Mark, and we'd think to ourselves, well, that's it, you know. But the fact that we have four is a reminder to us, I would like to think by God Himself, that there are different angles from which to come at to try to capture the complexity of who Christ is.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm good with all of it. And even those parts that, you know, pretty directly tell the story very differently, that's still okay.
You're okay with that. Now I
have to be. I don't have a choice.
You don't have a choice, yeah. You might as well go ahead and get used to it. This is reality. Now,
right, but I want to make sense of it, though, Luke. I want to try to understand why and what's the ultimate payoff by embracing the diversity, let's say.
Okay.
And you know, I'm not always 100% sure. You know, I mean, what I say in the book, I, you know, is you know, something I very much we believe and agree with, obviously. But I think the diversity of all these things shows us that just like our lives change and evolve and are diverse, and people at different points in time, we experience reality differently. I think we have a Bible that models that for us. Mm-hmm. We have a Bible that embraces the fact that the journey of faith differs among Christians in different places, different times, different churches. Mm-hmm. And I think the Bible is already modeling something of that for us by two different stories of Israel, or various traditions of, you know, the Mosaic period in the different places you read in the Pentateuch, or in the gospel records, or, you know, and how Paul tells stories maybe about Jesus, not many, but he seems to maybe think things occasionally that maybe the gospel writers wouldn't actually say, taking it a step further, whatever. But, you know, I think you have development and change and diversity in the Bible. And, you know, I think if there's any one idea that I'd like to try to communicate to readers who might be struggling with it, diversity is not a source of embarrassment. It's not, uh-oh, let's cover it up because we have to have this Bible that behaves itself. It is behaving itself. We just have to change our perspective.
Yeah.
And that's a statement of faith. That is a matter of faith. Yep, absolutely. Well, how do you know you're right? I don't.
Yeah. You've got this line where you say an unsettled faith is a maturing faith. And before that, Yeah. You say, regarding the specificity of the Exodus account, you say, I'm fine with not knowing. How can people get to a place where they can, first of all, not be embarrassed about the different accounts in the Gospels or the Chronicler compared to 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings? How can, first of all, they move past not being embarrassed of that to being okay and realizing, I don't have to have this all figured out?
Yeah. I think the easy answer, and I think this is not something that you can market, you know, but for me, the best answer to that is when people are ready, they will.
Yeah, you can't market that.
Yeah, you
can't.
What
does that mean to when they're ready, they will? How does that work?
Here's your 10-point step. But I think, you know, when I think of people that I know, including myself, who have sort of moved toward this position, you know, I didn't wake up one day and said, I think I'll be liberal. You know, or I think I'll undermine what I've always thought. I just, through a series of life experiences and, mm-hmm. you know, with the Wesleyan quadrilateral, you know, of experience and tradition and, you know, scripture and reason, you know, you start putting pieces together on your life journey where you say, you know, really what I used to think was super important, I still sort of get that, but I'm not there anymore. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't make sense to me. And I think people have to get to that point, which is, you know, it's hard to write books like I write because I know there are some people who are simply not ready for that conversation.
But what it does do...
People who are.
Yeah. But for those people who are, in some ways, you're giving language to what they're already experiencing and feeling, and you're making sense of this conundrum they find themselves in.
That's what I'm trying to do. I mean, in a nutshell, I'm trying to give language and a little bit of maybe a backing for people who are already there, and they either can't articulate it, or they can, but they're afraid to.
Yeah, and you also encourage people to let go of fear—the fear about being wrong about God.
Right.
How does that help?
Well, I think everyone, including myself, boy, do I do this. We do like to think that we've sort of nailed God down, and we sort of picture God in certain ways, and those ways are not always even clear to us. They're just operating on a very deep level. And oftentimes associated with that is, you know, the way I believe in God, what I believe about God, makes sense of the world that I live in. And I'm in control. Everything makes sense. The narrative is flowing of my life, and I sort of know what's up. I know what judgments to make. I know who's in. I know who's out. Mm-hmm. I know what books God reads. I know what movies he goes to. I know who's friends of his and who aren't. I know what actions he likes, what actions he doesn't like. I've got it all worked out. I think, you know, starting to think differently about God, if you're pushed in a certain way, that is fear-inducing because you can your life narrative can unravel a bit.
Yeah.
And no one likes that, including me. I don't like that. I don't say that flippantly. I just no one likes their narrative rewritten before their eyes. But I've come to believe that a maturing faith is one that puts an end to that cycle of fear,
mm-hmm.
and simply by faith trusts God enough to be in the game of rewriting our narratives, rewriting how we think about God. And we all could use that. We all have, you know, to use the well-worn phrase, we all have idols. We all make God in our own image. We all look in the mirror and there's God and there's us, and it's pretty much the same thing.
Yeah.
And even those who claim not to do that, I think, do it. Well, I'm not God. God's up there and he's sovereign, he's this or that. Well, even ideas like he's sovereign or he's wrathful or this or that, those are also reflections of what's going on deep down inside of us. That's not just coming from nowhere.
Yeah.
Right? So, you know, I think it's complicated, but I think letting go of the fear of God will get you if you're wrong on a theology exam. I know there's a caricature, but I also know that's true for many people. If I'm wrong in my theology, the whole Jenga tower falls down if one little thing is pulled out the wrong way. And I think God's in the business of just turning the table over and letting the whole Jenga pieces fall on the ground and say, let's try this another way that you're not expecting.
Yep. Well, on the subject of nailing God down, one of the things that you find in all four gospel accounts is when God gets nailed down, it's typically not a good thing. That was kind of the cross, wasn't it?
Yes, exactly right. You're right.
Okay, well, tomorrow, your book, The Bible Tells Me So, Why Defending Scripture Has Made Us Unable to Read It, comes out. Hopefully everyone gets a copy of it. Do you have big plans for the release day?
Not specifically for that day. I know that... I know that an interview that I did with Rob Bell is going to go up on the release day. Another one with Brian McLaren the week after.
Nice.
There are some things that are planned on my Facebook and on my website. You know, portions of the book, some quotes from the book.
Yeah.
And I'm doing a couple interviews this week too. So.
Outstanding. Well, it sounds like a fun week for you.
Yeah, it's a fun week. Absolutely.
Well, great. Well, Pete, we like the book, and thanks for your work on it, man.
Sure, Luke. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.